Welcome to Unraveling the Anthropocene, Race, Environment, and Pandemic, a podcast series brought to you by the Liberal Arts Collective, or LAC, at the Pennsylvania State University. As an interdisciplinary group, we promote visionary scholarship in the humanities, we build community across different fields of study, and we highlight the ways that different disciplines inform and shape one another. You can find more information about our previous events on our website, sites.psu.edu/liberalartscollective. In response to the COVID-19 pandemic this year, we have developed this podcast series as an intervention into our global ecological emergency. In our discussions with scholars, activists, artists, and community members, we address how global ecological crises both impact and are impacted by political turmoil, widespread outbreaks of infectious disease, and racial violence.
Hi, and welcome back to Unraveling the Anthropocene. In this episode, I, Merve Tabor, will be having a conversation with community organizers Colleen Unroe, Terry Blanton, and Jared Parson Brown-Hill. Colleen Unroe is a PhD candidate in adult education with a dual title in comparative and international education and a graduate minor in women's gender and sexuality studies at Penn State. She holds a bachelor's degree in environmental studies from Allegheny College, and she has received her master's degree in rural sociology from Penn State. Prior to graduate school, Colleen worked in Eastern Kentucky for 8 years as a community organizer with Kentuckians for the Commonwealth, a multi-issue organization focused on environmental, economic, and social justice. Her primary work consisted of supporting and engaging communities that are negatively impacted by the coal industry and are transitioning to a clean energy economy. Afterward, she continued her community organizing work on issues related to fossil fuels and hydrofracking in northeastern Ohio for several years. Her dissertation explores the education and learning involved with a just transition in central Appalachia and with social movements challenging the coal industry. Terry Blanton became involved in environmental activism after learning that her community in Harlan County, Kentucky, was poisoned by a coal mining equipment electrical repair shop in the early 1990s. She has been a community leader in environmental justice movements since serving as the chairperson for Kentuckians for the Commonwealth and as the Rockefeller Fellow at the University of Kentucky. She has also served on the EPA-appointed National Environmental Justice Advisory Council for 6 years, as well as the Alliance for Appalachia's Coordinating Committee. She has been the keynote speaker at numerous events, including KFTC's I Love Mountains Day. She has lobbied at the state and federal levels, engaged in protests across the country, and has received numerous awards, including one of the 100 top female leaders at the White House Women and the Environment Summit in 2013. Jared Parson Brown-Hill is a film, TV, and radio producer who has been documenting frontline communities impacted by environmental and social injustice for over a decade. Born and raised in Virginia's Shenandoah Valley, his love of mountains prompted him to establish the Topless America Project in 2007, with a mission to raise awareness of the devastation caused by mountaintop removal coal mining throughout Appalachia. As a citizen lobbyist and organizer, he later played a strategic role with the Chicago Clean Power Coalition campaign, which resulted in the shutdown of two of the oldest coal plants in the nation. He is now based out of Los Angeles, where he continues to be vigilant in his efforts to connect communities and empower others to raise their voices. Colleen, Terry, and Parson, thank you for joining us today. I've done a formal introduction, but I'd love to hear more about your path to environmental activism in your own words. When did you first get interested in environmental justice and community organizing, and how did you all meet?
Well, I'm going to start with my path. This is Terry, and my path is I grew up in a small community in Harlan County, Kentucky, which is in the eastern part of the state. And then the mining started happening all around me, destroying the mountains that I grew up in, the creek that I swam in, and destroyed people's water. So you no longer had access to clean water. So I'm fighting this coal company. And at the same time, I find out a company from Houston, Texas, a Fortune 500, had been dumping toxic waste on the ground in my community from 1951 to 1987. So I started learning more and more and more, and I met organizations that helped me along the way. And my first trainings was through the Highlander Center in Tennessee. And I guess learned more about the history of mountaintop removal and how, you know, the Appalachian Mountains are some of the oldest mountains on Earth. And we've actually blown up and destroyed almost 2 million acres of the Appalachian Mountains, second only in biodiversity to the rainforest in South America. And so people want to fight for, you know, the rainforest, but we really need to be thinking about what's happening in the eastern part of the United States through Central Appalachia. And as far as how we met, I'm going to let Parson and Colleen take that one because it all includes me.
Yeah, so I had initially gotten interested in environmental issues where I grew up in Northeast Ohio around water quality and doing water testing. And then during my summers in undergrad, I worked for a housing organization in Appalachia. And I remember having a conversation with one of the people that we were helping. She had needed housing assistance several summers in a row because of flooding problems. And I remember asking her what she thought needed to be done. And she talked about organizing. And so that was really what got me interested in organizing, was because it was pretty clear that Martha knew what the root of the problem was. She just didn't have the resources and the connections to be able to address the issue. And so after that point, I ended up becoming an intern with Kentuckians for the Commonwealth and later an organizer in it. So I met Terry through, she was very involved with the organization.
Well, for me, I grew up in the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia, what I consider to be, you know, perhaps the most beautiful place on earth. And I feel very fortunate to have come from there. And there was also, I grew up with a Superfund site in the town I grew up in. So I was, you know, always aware of environmental issues, but it wasn't until I went to college in Chicago in a very, you know, a new budding era of YouTube that I became aware of mountaintop removal coal mining that was taking place in Appalachia. I saw a video from the Alliance for Appalachia, and I was sitting with my friends in Chicago, a collaborative of film majors, radio majors, journalists, etc. When we saw the images of mountains being destroyed and heard the tales of you know, folks whose water was being poisoned and everything that was happening, it hit me very personally because I grew up in the mountains. Family home backs up against the George Washington National Forest. And the first initial thing that I thought of was like, oh my gosh, like it could be my backyard. It could be my mountain. And of course that opened up into a whole can of worms. So when we saw that video, that prompted us to come together and start a documentary project. And we traveled to Washington, D.C. to meet with the Alliance for Appalachia. And that is where I met Terry Blanton and Colleen and lots of other, you know, Appalachian residents and activists. And that's what really, really catapulted my involvement with environmental justice issues.
For our listeners who are not familiar with U.S. geography, could you explain what constitutes Appalachia and what are the main environmental justice issues impacting Central Appalachia at the moment?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'll just say that the Appalachian region of the United States, and we call it Appalachia, like throw an apple at ya, consists actually the Appalachian mountain range expands from Maine all the way down to Georgia, but primarily is when we think of Appalachia, we talk about Virginia, West Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee. And those are the most primary spots where mountaintop removal coal mining is taking place.
And remember the numbers that I just gave you. We're just talking about central Appalachia and losing 200 million acres of some of the most diverse hardwood forests in the world, and how that impacts water all the way on the East Coast.
Yeah. So Terry, do you want to expand on the main issues?
Oh, the main issues. Well, lack of clean drinking water, lack of jobs, lack of safety in the jobs, because people are so afraid to speak up about any infractions that happens on the in the workplace, because they're always told if you don't like what you're doing, there's 25 more, 100 more down the hill. But people's lack of clean drinking water, lack of access to healthcare, also food. It's sort of like a food desert. If you go to the grocery stores there, as opposed to grocery stores in the big city, it's much different. Just lack of respect for the neighbors. I mean, they don't care that they're blowing up a mountain and it's shaking your house off its foundations. And the responsibility of proving what they've done to you falls on you rather than on them. I've seen people's houses sink completely down into holes. And then I've seen people's houses be shook to where they're shaken off of their foundation. And that's from the blasting and blowing up the mountains. And of course, when you take a mountain that used to be 1,000 feet higher, and then you just flatten it out, and they build what's called valley fills. And instead of the natural streams that's flowing out where we get lots of water, like right now, we had about 6 inches of rain last night, and everything is flooded. The mountain communities are flooded. Houses are flooded. I mean, 6 inches is a lot of water to fall in one day. But the fact that you turn these mountains that used to hold back the water into something that looks like Walmart parking lots, it's no longer holding the water back. So the coal industry has always had all the money, so they always own the politics. There's never been a mine safety bill that's ever been written that wasn't written in the blood of a coal miner. Just a lack of caring for your neighbors. And you know, I was told one time about the community that I lived in and the Superfund sites, like, well, a lot of good men made a good living over there, but that doesn't justify my mother's life. That's about as deep as I can go right now.
In terms of historical context, coal mining started in the early 1900s. And for a number of years, it was primarily deep mining. And in the 50s and 60s, there was a shift towards surface mining. And then over time, mountaintop removal became the dominant form of mining, which is essentially strip mining on speed. And at this point, there are a lot of legacy effects of the history of coal mining, and there's been a lot of layoffs and a rapid decline in the number of jobs. And so people are still being affected, but it's manifesting a little bit differently.
Another thing that Terry reminded me of when she's discussing the current amounts of rain and flooding that's happening in Appalachia, we need not forget that the coal industry, specifically, not just in Appalachia, but primarily in the mountains, we have these what we call slurry impoundments, which are liquid coal waste that contain millions and some of them billions of gallons of coal waste, and have been known to break and, you know, demolish entire towns and cause vast destruction. And those are, you know, looming over communities in central Appalachia, always a constant sense of anxiety when the rain is heavy in the coal fields, because communities that are underneath these huge impoundments, whether they work for the industry or not, they know that that's a possibility, and that's a huge stress. There was even in a place in West Virginia, there was an elementary school called Marsh Fork Elementary School that has now been relocated, but it took, you know, it was an uphill battle for years. It would be ground zero, the first the first place hit, if the impoundment above it were to break, it was a 2.8 billion gallon slurry impoundment that's still there. And it took years to move an elementary school. Not even to mention the fact that the kids and students and teachers were experiencing health impacts due to their proximity to the coal operations. So that's just one part of the complexities of injustice in Appalachia.
Most people call it the life cycle of coal, and I call it the death march of coal, because the carbon release that it puts out through its entire being. So when they mine the coal, not only the machines that they're mining it with is releasing carbon and using lots of fuel, but also when they uncover the coal, it releases large amounts of methane. So then once they blast the mountains and they get the coal, then they truck it to a processing plant. And there's more carbon that they're using to process, plus they use chemicals to process the coal. These chemicals makes the coal float and the dirt and rock go down. And these impoundments that Parson was mentioning, we have probably about 130 in Kentucky alone. And what those impoundments are is the waste from processing this coal. And this is like the second stage of after mining, we process. And then they take all this refuge and they build these huge, they call them ponds, but they're really lakes, huge impoundments with millions to billions of gallons of this chemical-laced sludge. And so those are in the mountains. So now once you've processed the coal, you have to either truck it or train it, put it on a train and take it to the power plant. And then once it's in the power plant, it's burnt and it's also releasing more carbon. So, you know, we always hear like, if we can clean up what happens coming out of the stack and reduce the carbon coming out of the smokestacks of the power plants, then therefore it will help with global climate change. Of course it will help, but we're not looking at the entire death march of coal from the time it's mined to process to truck to all these different places. So it's much bigger than just what comes out of that stack. And then after that, then you have after they burn the coal, then you also have these, the coal ash or that, you know, the ash that's left over when it's burnt. And then that's usually stored in impoundments also. So you also have these other huge lakes of impoundments of this coal ash that's usually stored near waterways, because most power plants are by waterways. And one broke down in Tennessee probably about a decade ago. It was a Tennessee Valley Authority, also known as TVA. And it destroyed an entire community and an entire lake. And this was just the coal ash that happens at the end of the coal cycle.
Yeah, I mean, there's at every point in the coal cycle, it has negative impacts on the local communities. I think it's important to note that there's been a number of research studies that demonstrate a link between mountaintop removal and negative health effects, including 50% greater likelihood of dying of cancer and 42% more likely to be born with birth defects.
Thank you for this very informative explanation and for laying out the death march of coal for those of us who are not familiar with the process of coal extraction. In your answer, you've touched upon how certain groups have been affected by issues such as mountaintop removal, coal extraction, pollution, lack of access to clean water, and flooding in central Appalachia. Could you say a bit more about the impact of these environmental issues on different communities in the region? Which communities are affected the most?
The communities that live by these sites, the communities that live by the roadways or the train tracks, because the particulate matter that flies off of this coal as it's being transported, and also the people that live near the power plants. You know, they're And those are usually located in poor and mostly people of color communities. But, you know, in reality, everyone is impacted by this because of global climate change.
Just complimenting off of what Terry said, we are all affected. You know, as I mentioned before, my real start in environmental activism began when I was in Chicago. And we had a saying called From the Holler to the Hood when we introduced our friends and allies in Appalachia, where coal is being mined, to folks that we started organizing with in the neighborhoods of Little Village and Pilsen in Chicago, primarily Latino communities, communities of color, communities that are densely populated with two of the oldest, dirtiest coal-fired plants in the nation at that time, which we were able to close down by coalescing with within that city and with allies in Appalachia and abroad. So everybody is connected, whether you're in an urban city, a suburb, or in the hollers of West Virginia or Kentucky or Virginia, Tennessee.
Yeah, and there's a move towards building greater connections between frontline communities. And the Climate Justice Alliance is Kentuckians for the Commonwealth and a number of other organizations are a part of it, and really trying to make these connections between whether it's in an urban center or rural community, anyone affected by different aspects of the fossil fuel production.
I would love to hear more about your practice or your methodology, so to speak, as environmental activists. What are some of the strategies you use to hold the coal industry accountable for its actions? And how effective have these strategies been in bringing about change?
We catch them up on violations as much as possible. We've learned to do water testing to test the water for conductivity and total dissolved solids and the pH, which is the pH is very important. And the conductivity doesn't tell us what's in the water, but it tells us there is an issue. And so therefore we can file complaints with the state and the federal agencies. Needless to say, they haven't been very receptive lately. We're hoping that that will change with the new administration. Sometimes we do a little civil disobedience, and sometimes we sue them. Very often we do that too. Because sometimes nothing talks to them like an attorney.
You know, there's a whole range of ways to hold the coal industry or any, you know, bad actor accountable. And, you know, in our work, you know, as a documentarian, I've really seen that no matter what your strength is, you can bring it to an activism scenario. Whether you are working on legislation or writing a book or a poem, music or creating film, we call that artivism. You know, there's so many ways that you can make a difference, spread awareness, and get involved. So I guess the broader answer is whatever it is that you have to give, you can find a way to incorporate that into a movement, into raise your voice for the right thing. And Terry referenced, I gotta go here, she referenced our nonviolent civil disobedience, emphasis on the nonviolent and the civil. We have participated and helped organize tons of rallies, events, sit-ins, which Terry can tell you some more about. And we even had a huge rally several years ago called Appalachia Rising. We had thousands of people gather in DC. We surrounded the EPA building. We had a sit-in in PNC Bank, which was at that time one of the largest funders of mountaintop removal. And we had over 100 people sit down and be peacefully arrested in front of the White House. I'm just bringing that up because in our current political climate, you know, people who are fighting for their lives and have every right to be mad as hell to protect their land and their families and the health of their communities had every right to be furious, but we still organized and always put an emphasis on being peaceful.
So dovetailing with your practice as environmental activists, I'd like to ask you about the work you're doing on water justice. Earlier, you pointed out that access to clean water is one of the main environmental justice concerns affecting communities in Central Appalachia. What are some legal issues around water? You've also taken an active role in citizen lobbying efforts to improve existing laws on water protection. Could you tell us a bit about citizen lobbying? How does it work? What are its advantages and disadvantages?
Well, I'm going to take this one. So when we first started fighting it a couple of decades ago, I start thinking about lobbying decades. Senator Rahoff from West Virginia was on the committee. He chaired the committee that anything that we would take through SMACRA, which is a Surface Mining Reclamation and Control Act, and that was the first law that was ever passed on strip mining, and that was in the 70s. It wasn't acted on in Kentucky until the 80s. So the first strip mining laws that we had didn't start until the 80s in Kentucky. So anyway, we thought, well, the way to get around this is the way to get around Rahal, and this committee that we knew would not take us anywhere would be the Clean Water Protection Act. And President Bush had changed the wording that it was illegal to put fill in the stream. Oh, it is legal to put fill in the stream if you get a permit, like it's going to build a Walmart, a parking lot, and there's a reason that, so that's legal. So he changed the wording of co-waste from co-waste to co-fill, which made it legal to put co-waste into a stream. So our bill, the Clean Water Protection Act, was to fix that wording in that bill or in that law. So we worked on that for many, many years, and we take lobbying very serious, and we want to educate the people that are coming with us. And at the time, we would get people from across the nation that would be their constituent. They'd be a constituent of someone that was on the committee that we needed to reach out to. And we always have very good trainings, you know, a whole day of training before we go lobby. And it's some of the most powerful leadership training you can ever do, because I can remember taking people from Eastern Kentucky and you know, they really know their stuff when they go in there and they start talking to these people that's supposed to be representing them, and they would walk out there and they'd think like so proud of themselves because they knew that more than the person that they were talking to that was supposed to represent them. And it's just a very empowering thing to know what you're talking about and then go fight for it. Now, if we want to move forward with what's happening, we've been working on and have been working on for like many, many years. It's a reauthorization of the abandoned mine lands and also the reauthorization of the Black Lung Bill. And it's like before, I think the Black Lung Bill might have lasted 10 years and then they would kick it down the road and kept kicking it down the road. And the Black Lung Bill actually puts aside so much money from every ton of coal that's mined that pays coal miners after they get black lung, because most of the companies file bankruptcy and the coal miners are left with no health care coverage or no monies or no retirement. And if you've ever watched someone smothered to death from black lung, it's a really terrible thing. But so we have a couple bills. I'm not so sure they've been filed this year. I'm not up on it, but it's the Reclaim Act and the Abandoned Mine Lands reauthorization. I was with about 100 Black Lung people that went to Washington, D.C. pre-COVID. And, you know, most of them we had to push around in wheelchairs and stuff. And it's just really sad to see them suffering as they do and having to go beg for the benefits that they've worked for their entire lives and then to be ignored by their senator. I think the most important thing is to educate them so that they feel empowered when they walk into the room. And all the organizations that I've ever worked with always makes that a priority to make sure that the people know what they're talking about. And, you know, it's very easy to say, one thing we always taught everybody, if they ask you a question you don't know, don't pretend to know it. Just say, I don't know that. I'll get back with you about it, which gave people a little more courage, I suppose.
I would just echo what she said, certainly. But, you know, when I first came on the scene, it was, you know, the first real involvement that I had was I brought a group from Chicago to meet in DC for this lobbying effort. And Terry's absolutely right. It is so empowering. It was one of the most influential things that ever happened to me in my life. And I really mean that. I'm not over exaggerating, not just the compelling stories and, you know, powerful voices that I met, but realizing that I can walk into the office of Congress and I can educate them. I can speak to them. And you feel like this new sense of self. As we progressed, you know, then was able to help participate in the training. And I've went on to do lobby trainings in other places as well, and sharing that message, because it's really a powerful thing.
And one thing that I would add is just the importance of people sharing their stories. Certainly it's important to have data and research to demonstrate your point, but in the times that I've seen legislators change their position, it was usually based on hearing somebody personally affected by an issue. And in addition to doing the federal work, there's been a lot of lobbying at the state level as well. But in terms of things going on at the moment, Terry had mentioned the Reclaim Act. It's an effort to bring a lot of resources back to the region. It commits $100 billion to clean up polluted, abandoned coal mines. And so this has the potential to be a way to create new jobs through trying to address the legacy effects of the coal damage.
And it needs to be taken care of. We could put tens of thousands of people back to work, just destroying the stuff that the coal industry has left us. But unfortunately, they keep skipping out by doing bankruptcy over and over and over. And I guess you asked a question earlier about, I'm just going to go here with this since I'm here. So bankruptcy is a big issue, and lots of companies just forfeit their bonds, and Kentucky's bond has never a bond. You're supposed to put up a bond for the actual cost of reclaiming the land when you get finished mining it. And the bonds have never accurately addressed the actual cost of reclaiming sites. So right now we have so many companies that's filing bankruptcy, which takes away from the people that should be getting pensions and stuff from them, but also leaving the mess behind. And the one that you ask a question about, how do we sometimes get them to do what they're supposed to do? And so there's been a lot of stuff in the news about Black Jewel and Revelation. And at one point, Black Jewel had worked these coal miners for like a couple weeks or longer and didn't pay them. And this is in Harlan County. It is my home county. But they came in to take the coal out of the mountains by a train, and the coal miners actually stopped them from removing the coals. Like, you're not getting this coal. We mine this coal. And that went on for like, what, about 60 days or so?
I think it was longer than that, but
yeah.
So coal miners blocked the railroad. And so they set up and they were there for 24 hours a day and got a lot of news coverage. And it really helped to create solidarity within the region, people rooting for them. But then the other piece of this Revelation bankruptcy was all of the environmental impact. They wouldn't be addressing it.
So my part in this is I do some water testing, and then the community that I grew up in, the company also bought that one, the Revelation Black Jewel, and they have left a couple sites that, you know, you have to have standing in order to be in a lawsuit. So I'm in a lawsuit to against the state and the company and the state for not actually bonding it at what it should be, and the company for leaving it in a mess for two different sites, one in Harlan County and one in Macquarie County, to make them come in and actually do the cleanup as they should.
And I think in terms of addressing the question about what has been most effective, I think there are two things we had been discussing before. One is the importance of developing a diverse group of people to mobilize. And I think that that's one of the strengths of KFTC is that they're a multi-issue organization. And so people affected by issues in Harlan County will be standing with people trying to get accountability around Breonna Taylor. And so it's not just working on environmental issues, but recognizing that there's interconnections between various social justice issues and the importance of building that power collectively and working across lines of difference. And another piece is the importance of not just trying to stop destruction, but also being proactive and going on the offensive. And that's part of where the just transition efforts have come from in terms of trying to think about what can we proactively create in communities as opposed to just trying to defend against environmental destruction.
Colleen, you've underlined the significance of a multidimensional approach to just transition that pays heed to the intersection of questions of environmental destruction, racism, and labor rights. According to the Just Transition Alliance, and I'm quoting here, just transition is a principle, a process, and a practice. The principle of just transition is that a healthy economy and a clean environment can and should coexist. The process for achieving this vision should be a fair one that should not cost workers or community residents their health, environment, jobs, or economic assets. Any losses should be fairly compensated. And the practice of just transition means that the people who are most affected by pollution, the frontline workers and the fenceline communities, should be in the leadership of crafting policy solutions, end quote. So this is the definition provided by the Just Transition Alliance. What does just transition mean to you?
So I think the challenge is that there's different ways to conceptualize just transition, but in general, it's trying to move us in the direction of an economy that is sustainable and also protects workers in the process. And so it was originally coined when union workers came together with environmental activists, and it's certainly speaking to issues of clean energy, renewable energy, but can really encompass a much broader understanding.
I think on a, you know, liaison, speaking of on a broader scale, our nation needs a just transition in more than one way, you know, in several facets of our culture really are struggling right now. So yeah, we've got a lot of work to do, not just with environmental justice, but really healing as how we treat each other and how we build our communities and move forward all across the board as people.
Yeah. And in terms of like some specific examples that people have been working on in Appalachia around just transition, in Harlan County, people had put together a community energy project. So trying to help folks be able to access resources to improve the energy efficiency in their homes. So it creates jobs, it addresses issues around economic justice. They incorporated on bill financing to be able to create more resources for folks to be able to do that, incorporating solar energy into the local municipalities. For example, there's solar panels on the Coal Mining Museum in Benham. And also thinking more creatively about engaging with rural electric co-ops to push for energy efficiency and renewables. But it, like I said before, it's not just limited to thinking about restructuring the energy economy, but also thinking about broader issues of justice and, you know, how do we make sure that people have meaningful jobs that provide benefits and foster participation and collaboration.
And you know, what's really exciting is we worked really hard through the electrical co-ops to get some things implemented, and had a couple people on their board, which is really difficult to do. And, you know, there's like rebates if you buy a new refrigerator that's energy efficient. And my friends just bought a new place and got energy efficiency stuff. And it's like, call your electric company. And I think she's going to end up getting about $800. So, you know, seeing this actually happen to someone, it's exciting to know that your work helped put that there, put that money in her pocket.
Yeah, that's great to hear.
Parsons reminded me earlier that I said that, you know, we were creating energy out of coal when we were riding horses and buggies and sending people to the moon, and now we just landed on Mars. Surely we can create a way to make energy that doesn't destroy the Earth. But our people have been producing energy for this nation for over 100 years. And our hope is that when we do transition to a new energy economy, that our people gets to be a part of that transition. That's a part of the reclaim. It's like not only to reclaim it in a way that just fixes the land, but let's reclaim it in a way that's going to create jobs in the future.
Can I share a story? It may be out of context, but it's something that I think is worth telling. When we're talking about how the three of us tend to remind each other of things that have happened over the last decade or so. I mean, and this was years ago. At one point, this was during the Obama administration, we had a scheduled one of our events in Washington, D.C. We were going to rally at the EPA. We were bringing dirty water from Appalachia, poisoned water from mining communities, literally in jugs, and sitting down and surrounding the building just to give a very visual demonstration. That was the whole idea. Some of the challenges that we face as activists is that sometimes there are saboteurs from one direction or another. And there was one time where we got a warning. I believe it was from law enforcement. We can't remember if it was FBI or state police, but we were warned that there was a group of white supremacists at that time that were going to rally with us in the name of whatever their despicable message was. That wasn't the point. We had organizers staying up all night, making sure that like our wordage was clear. You had, you know, volunteers making patches that said anti-racist mess. Like we had to change everything. And again, I know that I keep revisiting this, but in the state of things and the energy that's in our nation right now, I just want to draw a clear contrast and to illustrate the contrast between what an organized, peaceful movement is versus how other things have gone completely sour in our nation. So I guess the point that I'm making is that there was an era in organizing in this country that felt like we were moving forward, and that I felt like I was so good because I was part of something that would stay up all night to make sure that we denounced racism and hatred. And that just speaks to what Colleen was saying, is that like we are a movement that's not just going to stand up for the clean water and for the mountains, but also just for the general welfare and equality and equity of all frontline communities.
That actually ties into the next question I want to ask about community organizing. How has community organizing changed over the years? And how has the pandemic affected your community organizing efforts? Could you talk a bit about your experiences as environmental activists who have been doing this work for decades? And I'm also curious to hear, you're collaborating with national organizations and initiatives, surely, but are you also in communication with international organizations?
Yeah, part of my work over the years has specifically been in coalition building and networking, starting with organizers in Appalachia who were also partnered with Big Greens in the United States, Sierra Club, Rainforest Action Network, and Greenpeace at times. There are those large organizations which are international, and organizations that I've worked with have certainly reached across internationally in lots of different ways, whether it be in Central and South America, in Colombia, there's issues happening in France that I've worked with some folks on redeveloping communities so that they're more eco-friendly and efficient. And maybe Terry can touch more on this too, but yeah, definitely building your network and reaching as far as you can is so important. Communicating with people everywhere and hearing from them and hearing their stories is really important. The more souls you can get involved, the more power you can wield.
Also through Climate Justice Alliance, you know, there's a lot of Native Americans that is a part of it, and they don't recognize the border. So yes, from Canada to Mexico, lots of Natives. And we've also joined up with some countries in Central and South America and haven't been a part of the conversations lately, but yeah, what affects one affects us all. So we have to work together any way we can. The worst thing you can possibly do in community organizing is go into a community and tell them what they need. You go and listen to the community, and then you help the community achieve their need. But the worst thing you can do is come in and it's like, oh, I know what you need. So people know who they are, and they know what they need, and they know what they want. And to help them achieve that is the best thing to do. But changing, and it's so hard to think pre-COVID right now, you know, as far as community organizing. I think some, even pre-COVID, I think we moved too far into just electronic organizing and not so much as one-on-one as we should have and should continue, because that's how it really works. And also, like Colleen mentioned, the connection between the people living by the coal-fired power plant and Louisville and the people being impacted in where the coal is coming from. And just those interchanges are so important. But I mean, my hope is that, I know everything has to be Zoom right now, but my hope is that when we do get out of this apocalypse that we're in right now, this pandemic, that we do go back to knocking on each other's doors and sitting down at the kitchen table and having frank conversations about issues that are affecting us. And I'm just really concerned that we don't continue on with this kind of work and move back to the personal engagement with people.
Yeah, there's definitely been an increase in the use of technology, and that in some ways it can increase capacity, but in others it doesn't necessarily facilitate the relationship building, which is such a key part of community organizing. You know, webinars can be helpful in terms of distributing information, but really it's the developing the relationships that help to facilitate longer term engagement. Certainly use of like text messaging and action alerts and those things can help to distribute information in a massive scale, and it can facilitate some engagement. There's pros and cons, and there needs to be both.
I think that I'm not really sure what lobbying is going to look like moving forward in the immediate future in a post-COVID world. And in fact, that's something that we've already begun conversations about, is, you know, how do we adapt? So utilizing technology is great and extremely helpful in many ways, like Colleen said, but there's something about making that connection to your lawmakers. This is an interesting time as far as troubleshooting and figuring out, you know, the most efficient and safe way to still do business on the Hill, if you will.
Thanks for addressing the question of how the COVID-19 pandemic has impacted community organizing, because on the one hand, it has become easier in some ways to access information, as you said, Colleen, through webinars and digital communication, etc. But on the other hand, there is the issue of, well, who has access to the technology necessary to participate in these platforms?
That's true. I mean, you know, what really frightens me about the insurrection, the rioting in D.C., and it's like, you know, I know we need some bills about it, but I get so frightened when we start thinking about writing bills and how it can limit our access to lobby, you know, how it can access our ability to do civil disobedience I mean, not killing anyone or just letting our voices be heard. And right now, I think we're in a frightening time about that. Where do you draw the line? The fact that you would block somebody from Facebook. I don't know. I get a little weary when we start thinking about that, because I don't want my voice to be silenced in any way.
Yeah, I think we're, you know, what has happened in recent events has really damaged, is going to cause lasting damage to the process of engagement when it comes to activism and nonviolent civil disobedience. Because I think about the energy that we've had in rallies in the past, and as rightfully so, as angry as our folks have been, you know, storming the Capitol, you know, harming officers, harming anyone was so far removed from our plan ever, that I think for, you know, when it comes to protests, rallies of all kinds, like, we're going to have to really be more sensitive and rethink how we're going to do some of these things.
Well, and I think to your point is, like, there are real questions in terms of access, particularly, you know, in rural communities. They don't necessarily have broadband. People still have dial-up or cannot afford having the internet, or don't necessarily have the skills to be able to engage in that way. And so if we only rely on technology, then it's really missing a huge portion of the population. And if you're invested in helping people that are underrepresented find a voice, then that can create an even larger barrier.
So before we end our conversation, I have one question specifically for Parson and a general question for everyone. So Parson, you are a documentary filmmaker. Could you tell us a bit about how you tackle environmental justice issues in your documentaries? What are some challenges you've encountered in your practice? And the second question is for all three of you. Based on your experiences, what would you recommend to aspiring environmental activists?
When I first heard about mountaintop removal coal mining with my group of friends, fellow students in Chicago, you know, I was just irate. And we decided that we needed to do something. So we started something called the Topless America Project to organize around mountaintop removal coal mining and to spread awareness. That project continues to this day. And we're actually still working on distributing more and more of that in a more historical perspective at this point. In addition, since I've started that, I've now worked in what I kind of refer to as rural production. I sort of specialize in helping networks. I've worked with CNN, History Channel, Discovery Channel to be support their productions, be a liaison. I say that, you know, I jokingly say that I speak hillbilly, and I say that with pride because I am a proud hillbilly and I do not consider that a slur in any way. I think Terry and Colleen will agree with me there. So yeah, there's a lot of things that you do need to be aware of when you are shooting or, you know, filming in places where they don't necessarily want you to be. You have to be careful. We've faced intimidation. Sometimes you have to go across the red tape. We've gotten some threats and some pushback, but the most important thing is to be brave enough to travel, be brave enough to ask people questions, and really listen. Listen, and that's the way to gain people's trust and be genuine. Hear what they have to say. Don't just come in and act like you're, you know, don't have an attitude like you're somehow better. I like to say, be more than a lens. Get involved. If I had just been a lens, I don't think that my life would have been the same. Meeting activists like Terry and Colleen and many more has changed my life. Being involved in the movement more than just being a camera person or being a producer has been one of the most gratifying and wonderful honors I've had as a person. So I would say to aspiring filmmakers, be more than a lens And don't be afraid or intimidated because you might not have the right equipment. You know, there might be larger entities, there might be bigger producers and stuff around you. Just go in and do it. You know, ask your questions. Don't be afraid to call Congress. Step up there and be loud. What's the worst that can happen? And if your footage isn't that great, ultimately, your content is what counts. We were so nervous about that back in the day, but now you look at people becoming famous off of TikTok. So just share what you've got.
What would you recommend? Never give up. And you're not in it for the short haul. You have to be in it for the long haul. I'm 64, probably been doing this all my life. Just don't give up. And your voices do matter. And your vote matters quite a bit. And one thing I always talk about is democracy doesn't only end when you vote, but democracy is happening every single day. So you need to know what's happening every single day. What kind of bills is being filed in your state? What kind of bills is being filed in the federal house that's going to affect you? And just keep learning. And I'd say the most important thing is to find a group that you identify with. Because when I used to stand down there and watch their holler, I felt like I was a lone wolf. And I picked up Kentuckians for the Commonwealth's Balancing the Scales, their newspaper, and I read it and I said, damn, they think the same way I do. You know, so I found my community. And there's power in numbers. Really, it's exciting to think that I could climb on an airplane and fly anywhere in this country and walk into a room full of 200 people and feel like I belong there because they're there with the same heart that I have. And so I guess never give up and never think it's a short term and never think that your voice don't count, because it counts and your vote counts a whole lot too. So just stay involved.
The one thing that I would add is that I think it's important to recognize that taking care of yourself is also a part of movement work, because a lot of people burn out. And the reality is that, like Terry said, it's a long haul. And so you have to be able to take care of yourself through the process, and recognizing that there's a lot of different ways to be involved. And so thinking about what your strengths are and how you can contribute in that way. And I think the other thing that I often ask people is how you have hope in those situations, because there's so many problems that need to be addressed. And so I think recognizing and embracing and celebrating the small victories, I think, is really important as well.
Totally agree with that one, because it seems like now that I've slowed down a little bit in COVID world and I start thinking about all the stuff that I've done. And it's like when you're in the mix of it all and you're doing it, it's like you don't even have time to think about what you just did because you're too busy thinking about what you got to do next. And, you know, that's slowing down. And I think I would tell someone that if you don't feel comfortable, if someone asks you to do something and you don't feel comfortable, it's okay for you to say no. And just like Colleen said, if you're a good organizer, then you can pick out what people's strengths and weaknesses are and build off of those.
I agree with everything that they said, of course. And the only thing I would add is just, you know, always try to keep diversifying your coalition and reach out to folks of all different backgrounds and walks of life, and, you know, support each other. Maybe your fight is not specifically the same as theirs, but as Terry said, like, you know, have the same heart and take that empathy with you, you know, into all situations. So you can help your neighbor, you can help your friend, you can meet a stranger and realize they need help too, and just sort of be fluid with your activism. Activism isn't something that just, it's like a 9-to-5 thing. It's a lifestyle. And it's because you have, you know, when you feel passionate about other people and their quality of life, these are the things that keep us up at night. So try to bring everybody in that you can.
Colleen, Terry, Parson, thank you so much for this informative conversation that was inspiring in so many different ways. And thank you for your encouraging words to other community organizers and environmental activists. It was a pleasure to talk to you and to learn from you. Unraveling the Anthropocene is brought to you by the Liberal Arts Collective at Penn State. This series was made possible by sponsorships from the University Park Allocation Committee, the Department of Comparative Literature, the Department of Spanish, Italian, and Portuguese, the Rock Ethics Institute, the Humanities Institute, and the Center for Global Studies. We at LAC thank you for your support. This episode was produced by Merve Tabur. Be sure to subscribe and follow along wherever you get your podcasts and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The Unraveling the Anthropocene project is getting bigger. During the spring and summer of 2021, we will be running a reading group to discuss the topics of race, environment, and pandemic. To join, visit our website or find Unraveling the Anthropocene on Goodreads.com. See you next time!